From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orbán won re-election easily in yet another affirmation of authoritarian right-wing policies in Europe. It is a troubling trend, not just in Europe, but of course, right here in the United States, and in Latin America, in Asia, and elsewhere. In a world that is more interconnected than ever, and where awareness of human rights is greater than ever, how do we explain the tilting toward demagoguery? A new book by the co-founder of The American Prospect, Robert Kuttner, attempts to answer that question by pulling together various developments into a broader economic and social picture where capitalism has run so amok that it has undermined democracy. Robert Kuttner is the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect, former columnist for Business Week, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe, the author of 11 books. He holds the Meyer and Ida Kirsten Chair at Brandeis University and joins me to discuss his latest book, Can Democracy Survive Global Capitalism? Welcome to the program, Robert.
Very happy to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So you, in your book, put the election or the Electoral College win of Donald Trump in a global context, which I think is really critical. Here in the U.S., many of us have been despairing of what we have experienced under Trump, but it seems to be a troubling trend in one country after another. Hungarians just chose their right word, very right-wing, anti-immigrant racist party, and we see this not just in Europe, we see it in Asia. Just broadly speaking, why do you see this sort of trend at a time when awareness of human rights is greater than ever, at a time when we seem to be more interconnected than ever?
Yes, well, that's the question, isn't
yeah.
it? I take a historical view of this, and I think there was a remarkable period after World War II when the politics played out on both sides of the Atlantic in such a way that capitalism was highly regulated. It was really more like social democracy. And many of the more toxic tendencies of capitalism were harnessed. Capitalism, as I like to say, was housebroken. What does that mean? It means that finance was regulated very tightly. It means that labor unions were empowered. It means that democratic governments were empowered and democracy was broadened. And there were lots of public investments. It was a period when social benefits were expanded. And as a consequence, ordinary people felt that the system was basically fair. Now, granted, there was a lot of unfinished business. It was still a very patriarchal system. It still had colonies in some places, and African Americans did not have full rights in the United States. But compared to the capitalism that existed in the 20s or the 30s or in the 19th century, this was a much more balanced system. And my generation grew up thinking of that as normal. In fact, it was quite abnormal. And it took Roosevelt, it took the defeat of Hitler, it took a kind of common sensibility after World War II. The architects of the post-war order concluded that we are never, ever again going to let 30% unemployment lead to fascism and war. Okay, so that system starts coming unglued in the 1970s, and the normal power of capitalists in a capitalist economy start roaring back. And this is begun really because of the stresses of the 1970s. It opens the door to Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher in England. And so you get a more typical capitalism of great inequality, great instability, and ordinary people start getting anxious about their livelihoods being destroyed. And this really comes to a head politically after the financial collapse of 2008. Now, I can go on and on and on, but I'm going to stop there because you probably have some questions.
Yeah, so it seems as though we have populations, of course, that are squeezed economically? So you said in the 30s, this was or in the early part of the 19th century, 20th century, we saw people being squeezed with very high unemployment rates. We saw the rise of fascism. Is this an inevitable cycle that when times are good, we relax financial regulations, capitalism comes roaring back, squeezes the little guy and girl, and then we have rightward trends once more till this can be brought under control again?
It's not because times were good. Times were bad in the 1970s. We had a combination of inflation and high unemployment, and that allowed the right wing to say, hey, maybe we can do it better. And it was those circumstances that allowed the election of Margaret Thatcher in Britain and Ronald Reagan in the United States and conservatives elsewhere in Europe. But they were not ultra-right fascist conservatives. They were just ordinary free market pro-business conservatives. And I think what happens after 2008, when you have hyper-globalization, depriving ordinary people of decent jobs, and then on top of it, increasing immigration, and on top of that, you have a greater consciousness on the part of African Americans, on the part of immigrant groups. So you have a clash between groups that are very properly demanding inclusion and local people feeling that they have just been clobbered economically. And it's very hard to ask local people whose livelihoods have been taken away to open their hearts to immigrants.
And by local people, do you mean, I mean, that should include African Americans in the U.S.?
Yes, but the problem is that race then displaces class. So instead of white people and black people in the United States seeing their common interests as members of other than the 1%, what happens is that a guy like Donald Trump comes along and racializes economic grievances. And instead of white working people appreciating that the enemy here is Wall Street, Trump narrates this in such a way that the enemy is immigrants, the enemy is African Americans. And tragically, he was very successful. Well, he wasn't very successful. He was successful enough, right? He lost by 3 million votes, but he was successful enough in the upper Midwest and in Western Pennsylvania to win just enough votes of angry white people by persuading them that rather than the enemy being people like himself, corrupt billionaires, that the enemy was immigrants, the enemy was others, the enemy was African Americans. And I think the challenge is to put this back into a politics of class where Hispanic people, Latinos and African Americans and white working class people appreciate what the real source of all this trouble is. It's not each other. It's the fact that Wall Street and billionaires like Trump are making off with too much of the economic pie. But that politics is very difficult. And the reason that it's very difficult is that the nominally center-left party, especially the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party, has gotten into bed with Wall Street. And so when you
I think that's a really critical issue, right? Because, of course, the Democrats ended up joining with the right on issues of empowering Wall Street. And they've been partying it up. And then when people get upset, they have unfortunately separated identity politics from class politics.
Exactly. And so you look at the fact that Bernie Sanders, who came out of nowhere, who's a 74-year-old Jewish transplant to Vermont, almost beat Hillary Clinton, who had the entire Democratic Party machinery on her side. It gives you a sense of the hunger that's out there for a different kind of politics. But except in Britain, where the leader of the opposition is Jeremy Corbyn, who's a genuine progressive, in the rest of Europe, the Social Democratic Party or the Labour Party, the nominally center-left party, is part of the globalist consensus. And so when people who feel that their livelihood has been taken away look for an alternative, they don't find one on the center left, and they unfortunately look to neo-fascists. Right. And that's tragic. And it's why we need left-wing parties to become more effective so that there's a counter narrative and there's an alternative. Because otherwise, when people are stressed, white people in particular, local people in places like Hungary or Poland or even Britain, when they feel stressed, they turn to ultranationalism and they turn to racial scapegoats and immigrant scapegoats. And this latent politics of class that is possible, that is necessary, never comes together.
Right. It's that adage, when you've been used to privilege all of your life, equality feels like oppression, except we're all struggling from oppression. Some of us are just not as used to it as others. So in your book, you write about this economist that's very little known, but who really had a strong understanding of some of these economic and social trends, Karl Polanyi. Tell us a little bit about him and why he's important.
Polanyi, I love Polanyi because he wasn't a real economist, and I'm not a real economist, and Polanyi was self-taught. So he grows up in the 19-teens and 20s. He becomes an economics journalist, and he gets very interested in history, and he realizes that the whole tragedy of the early 20th century was as a result of market forces, capitalism, overwhelming everything else, and that the move to fascism has to be understood as ordinary people being frightened and turning to the right. Now, in Vienna, where Polanyi worked and lived for about 15 years, it was known as Red Vienna. There was a very, very successful socialist municipal government, pro-worker government, that was phenomenally popular. But that was the exception. And when the fascists took over in the early 1930s, there were no democratic left alternatives permitted. And so Polanyi warned that if you let markets take over everything else, you're going to get a very nasty right-wing reaction. And of course, that's what happened. And then Polanyi lives long enough to see the alternative. The alternative is that you have a kind of social democratic or democratic socialist form of government where entrepreneurship is prized, but the destructive tendencies of capitalism are contained, and you have 30 years after the war of balanced prosperity where there is no appeal of the fascist right, and then it falls apart all over again. And I guess Polanyi died before he could witness the tragedy of having it fall apart all over again. But I like Polanyi because he really has a long-term sense, beginning with Britain in the 17th century, of how, when markets overwhelm everything else, you create the preconditions for fascism.
So democratic socialism, which is what, for example, Bernie Sanders has talked about. We see several Scandinavian countries who fit that mold. Can they survive the turn to fascism? Does it depend on the continual reining in of financial markets and eternal vigilance?
Yes, that's it. You said it better than I did. It requires the eternal vigilance and the continuous reining in of finance, and that means strong democracy, because the power of capital in a capitalist economy is so profound that unless you have very strong democracy and countervailing power of what? Of mobilized people, of social movements, of strong trade unionism, of cross-racial class coalitions, then you can fight capitalism to a draw, and maybe even you can have something like democratic socialism. But if you don't do that, capitalism overwhelms democracy and you get fascism. And even in Scandinavia, you are finding social democracy or democratic socialism weakened because ordinary people, local people, feel that their livelihoods are slipping away from them. And they blame immigrants. And so even in the most progressive countries in Europe, that social model is at risk.
And why is it at risk? Is it because the Scandinavian democracies are facing pressure from the rest of Europe to deregulate their markets?
Exactly. The European Union, which has a nice welfare state, but the European Union is also a force for austerity. It's also a force for liberating free markets. And as a result, the more managed form of capitalism all over Europe, any country that's a member nation of the EU, is weaker than it was 15 years ago, and you add immigrants to that stew, you get good trade unionists in places like Denmark or Sweden defecting to the right-wing party because they see social benefits being consumed by immigrants. They see immigrants speaking a different language, people of a different color, in communities that have always been pretty homogeneous. And maybe they can tolerate that when economic times are good. But when they're losing their own jobs, all of that tolerance and compassion starts slipping away.
Hmm. So where does China fit into all of this? China is a country that has a very, very strong state and competes globally in a capitalist and very competitively, if not, you know, it may be the top competitor in a capitalist globalized world, but it doesn't necessarily consider itself a capitalist country within China.
Well, China practices a combination of state capitalism and dictatorship. And there's a word for that. There's a very precise word for that, and the word is fascism. When you have the state running everything, including the economy, and you have the state being allied with powerful industrial groups, and you have the state not allowing any democratic opposition, that's fascism. And I think the Bill Clintons of the world, the Barack Obamas of the world, even, and there are a lot of great things about Barack Obama, but both of them were very naive about China. They believed that if we just set a good example and let China into the World Trade Organization and pretended that China was a country like any other country, China would evolve into a capitalist market democracy. And of course, that didn't happen. And so the question now is, well, what sort of policy with China would make sense? And I think for the rest of the world trading system, it's very important to work out an accommodation with China that allows China to have its own system, do whatever it wants. We're not going to make over China's system. We don't have that much power, and we shouldn't have that much power. But at the same time, the West has a right to defend what's left of its own norms. So if we have labor standards and Chinese companies or American companies in China pay workers, one step above slave labor, there should be tariffs, there should be quotas, there should be some kind of tariff against social dumping. And if China steals American intellectual property, we should also sanction that. Now, the problem is that Trump has talked about some of this, but he's talked about it in a completely xenophobic and incoherent way. And assuming this country remains a democracy, if we're fortunate enough to elect a progressive democratic president, we need a very different sort of China policy that limits the damage China can do to the rest of the trading system, but still allows China to pursue its own path to develop. And there are some things we can learn from China. China spends a fortune on public investment. We should be doing that in the United States.
Right, and we don't hear much about that. Some might say that, we need to overthrow capitalism altogether and revert to purely socialist states. And I know you write about that a little bit in your book. How do you respond to that?
I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, I think the kind of democratic socialism that Bernie Sanders talked about, I think that was surprisingly popular given the fact that the United States is usually seen as a country that doesn't have much sympathy for socialism. So I think a program that talked about the need to re-regulate finance, a program that talked about the need to go back to free higher education, certainly free higher public education, universal health insurance, massive public investment so that we can have a green transition, a massive investment in decent infrastructure so that we can modernize our systems and produce a lot of good jobs at the same time. That's, you could call that social democracy. You could call it democratic socialism. That program would gain a lot of support. I think the idea that we're just going to somehow overthrow capitalism, that's a little bit romantic. Even if it were a good idea, I don't think it's going to happen.
If it was attainable, do we end up with authoritarian states? And there have been some examples of that where, it may sound very nice in principle to have an entirely socialist state, but does one want to live in, the Soviet Union of the past?
Right. Well, I certainly don't. Yeah. And I think revitalizing democracy as its own goal in and of itself is every bit as important as having a socially just society, and the two things go together. The only way you're going to housebreak capitalism is if you have a democracy that's strong enough to insist on it. And the more people lose faith in democracy, the more the billionaires gain control of everything, because wealth translates into power. And the more wealth translates into power, the more people give up on democracy. So it's a vicious circle. It needs to be turned back into the kind of virtuous circle that we had for the 30 years after World War II and also under Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Is the American Prospects website the best place to read your writing, in addition to, of course, people being able to pick up your book at bookstores?
Yes, and I also have a website of my own called robertkuttner.com, and you can see all of my writings there. But please go have a look at prospect.org and take a look at the book, Can Democracy Survive Global Capitalism?
We'll post links to those websites later today. Robert Kuttner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Robert Kuttner is the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect, former columnist for Business Week, The Washington Post, and The Boston Globe, and the author of 11 books. And we've been discussing his latest book, Can Democracy Survive Global Capitalism? I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.